There's only one organ system that we haven't treated in this two-term journey, and that's the reproductive system. And there's a couple major reasons why the reproductive system is unusual compared to the other organ systems. Anyone guess either of these two reasons I'm thinking of? Yeah. Yeah, one is that it's the organ system that you can live without. Because it's not about your life, it's about the next generation. And choosing not to procreate is not only ecologically sound, it won't kill you. What's another reason, though, that it's different from the other organ systems? Yeah, that is that's an interesting difference, but the and that's so there's more than two differences. The other one that I was thinking of, though, that would be more likely to be answered by someone not as familiar with the intricacies of biology, for instance, a kindergartner maybe, would be that there's different versions for the two genders, right? There's a male version and there's a female version. Don't have that. I mean, there's male. Male muscular system is a little bit different from a female muscular system in terms of the mass of the muscles and things like that, but there's not major differences between male and female version of the other organ systems like there is in the reproductive system. And that's why, even though we're going to stay on one organ system for the rest of the term, for the final unit, we're going to do it as two different chapters. So we'll do it in order of importance, starting with the male. That's just a little joke. There's not one system that's more important than the other. They're both equally needed if the intent is to reproduce. And we should actually talk about the major functions since we're in a new organ system. The reproductive system, of course, is about reproduction, about producing another generation of humans. But if we think about them as separate subdivisions of the reproductive system, the male and the female version, what is the function of the male reproductive system? To produce gametes, right? What are gametes, first of all? They are sex cells. Gametes is the unisex term. So there's a male version of a gamete, there's a female version of a gamete in any sexual species, right? Gametes are sex cells. What makes them sex cells is that they can fuse together in order to make a new individual. Now, what do we call the fusion of those gametes? I'm going to pretend that I can't hear you unless everyone in here can hear you.
You said fertilization.
Fertilization is the union of two unicellular gametes to produce a unicellular zygote. And that's how you all started your life officially, as one cell called a zygote that was created when your father's sperm merged with your mother's egg. The egg and sperm, though, are examples of gametes. Gamete is just the unisex term for a sex cell. So that's the essence of sexual reproduction. Any sexual species will have some form of fertilization in which two gametes from separate parents get together to produce an offspring that is different genetically from either of the two parents. That's the essence of sex. That's why it works evolutionarily. There are advantages to sex. There are advantages to asexual lifestyle as well. But the big advantage of sex is that it mixes things up genetically. The offspring are not the same as their parents, which can be bad or good, but sometimes it's good. Anyway, the reproductive system in general, a major function of it is the production of gametes, because if you don't have these gametes, then you don't have the next generation. You don't have fertilization occurring. But the male version of the reproductive system has a shorter list of functions. I was joking earlier when I said we're going to do males first because it's order of importance. We could think of it as we're doing it in the reverse order of complexity, because male reproductive system isn't as nearly as complex as a female's. And it doesn't have as long a list of functions. One of those functions, though, is the production of sperm, the male version of gametes, and the delivery of those sperm to the female. Another function, though, is to control the development of what we call secondary sexual characteristics, which in a male are things like pubic and axillary hair, chest hair, a bulking up of the musculature compared to adolescence, things that, at least in some cases, attract females. Those are secondary sex characteristics. And that's really about it for the male. A female does the same things, basically. There are secondary sex characteristics in females, like the enlargement of the breast beyond just for lactation, just to get bigger, in other words. The curves that develop compared to a prepubescent female, those are secondary sex characteristics. And the main job for a female reproductive system is the production of her gametes, which are the eggs, which happens quite a bit differently from how sperm are produced, as we'll talk more about as we go. But in addition to just producing the gametes, a female female's reproductive system also has to receive the male gamete, allow for the fertilization of those two gametes, house the resultant zygote, and house the embryo that results from that zygote, and house and nourish that fetus that develops from the embryo. So those are three major stages in mammals in general, but humans specifically. You start out as a zygote. That's a single cell. That develops into a multicellular embryo first, which continues to grow and develop. But then eventually it becomes named a fetus, which is even bigger and more developed than the embryo. All of this is happening inside the reproductive tract of the female. So, purely in terms of physiology, the male's job is done after the sperm is delivered. And the female is physiologically responsible for the rest of it, including bearing what will eventually be called the baby after it's expelled from the uterus, fetus up to that point, and baby after it emerges. Nowadays, fairly few women die from that experience, but it's caused a lot of deaths in our history. And of course, the job is not done after that point in terms of having a human that can exist on its own. We're altricial species, meaning that when we're born, we're pretty helpless. So there's a lot of parental care that goes into making a child that, or eventually a human that can support itself. But really, that's not any longer part of the function of the reproductive system. Strictly speaking, the reproductive system's job ends at birth. Well, I'm sorry, not at birth, but after nursing, because the reproductive system, another thing on that list of females' reproductive system's job is to support the baby by nursing it. Okay, so in each of these two versions of the reproductive system, there are primary and secondary sex organs. Now, what is the primary sex organ of a male? It is not penis, no. It's testis. What makes it the primary sex organ is that it produces the gamete, which is really what it's all about. Okay? So a male happens to, most males happen to have two duplicate organs that produce gametes, sperm for the male, and those are the testes. The testes is a plural word, but it's not the plural of testy, which does not exist as a word. Yeah, the singular is testis, just like crisis is singular and crises is the plural. Testis is one of them. Testes are two or more. And similarly, the word penis, which also has the is ending in the singular, what is the plural of penis? Penes, correct. Although most people have, most males have just one penis. So we use the singular of that usually and the plural of testis usually, but realize what those proper singulars and plurals are. So the penis is not the primary sex organ in a male. It's a secondary sex organ. It's really just a delivery device, right? The testis produces the viable sperm. The sperm are small, motile gametes. Motile meaning that they're able to move from point A to point B, which is important in the overall job of getting the two gametes together so that fertilization can take place. By the way, what is the difference in any given sexual species? What is it that makes the female and the male? Size of what? Size of the gamete, right. I mean, there are plenty of sexual species that, because they look totally different from us, you wouldn't be able to tell which is the male and which is the female. But the female is the one that makes the bigger of the gametes. And that's because in order for a zygote, which is the union of the two gametes, to be viable, it needs to be as large as possible to house the nutrients, to survive as a cell, basically, and to house the nutrients. So one sex specializes in producing a big gamete so that the zygote can be big as possible and therefore survive. And the other one produces a small gamete that's able to move from point A to point B easily because the two gametes have to get together. So the big one, which would be hard to move, sticks around. The small one, which is easier to move, goes toward the big one. Well, whichever sex makes that bigger one is, by definition, the female. And this, by the way, is one of the reasons why gamete production in females is different from males, but I'll get into that at a different chapter. Okay, so in males, the primary sex organ is the two testes, and penis is secondary, scrotum is secondary, and so on. The figure here, well, by the way, just even though this is the male version, the male chapter, in females, what is the primary sex organ? The ovaries, right. They produce the eggs directly. Anyway, back to this first slide. In this table, notice what we're looking at are external versus internal genitalia, which is the plural of genital. And so these are just what you would think based on the name. External genitalia are visible without dissecting the human. Outwardly visible. And so those include in the male the penis and the scrotum. Whereas the internal genitalia, you would have to cut the person open to see, basically. And that's most of what we call the reproductive tract. Males have a reproductive tract, and females do as well. Even though males don't give birth, it's not a birth canal. It's a reproductive tract, though, because things move through it, just like in the digestive tract. And that starts out at the testes, but includes a bunch of tubes from the testes onward, eventually to the tip of the penis, from which sperm, as part of semen, are ejected. And so notice that in this list of internal genitalia, along with the testes, are structures that lie right next to the testes in the scrotum. And each one of those is called an epididymis. Notice what the plural of epididymis is. Epididymides, which few people use in real life, but that's the correct plural. Epididymides, which is proper because we do have two, males have two, but each one is individually called an epididymis, which means a twin body. We'll look at the epididymis in a minute, but also there are tube. There's a tube arising from each testis, arising from each epididymis, and that's called a ductus deferens. That's the singular. Notice that that also has a unusual plural. Deferentes is the plural of deferens. So, actually, I think it's more proper to say that the plural is ducti deferentes rather than ductus deferentes. You pluralize both. Anyway, that's both of them. And the ductus deferens can also be called what? The vas deferens, V-A-S, correct. Vas, as in vascular, means tube, vessel. Ductus also means that. Somewhere along the line, they changed, the anatomists got together and said, let's no longer call this the vas deferens, let's call it the ductus deferens. They mean exactly the same thing. But this is the more modern terminology. The older terminology, the vas deferens, is why cutting that surgically is called a vasectomy. All right, then there are seminal vesicles, which add secretions to the stuff that is becoming mature semen along the way, and we'll look at this process as we go. The prostate adds its own components to the mixture. Semen is more than just sperm, is what I'm trying to get at. It's sperm plus other secretions from these accessory glands along the way that are part of the internal genitalia. And then the bulbourethral glands also produce their contribution, mucus, which is the final bit that's added. By then you have full semen. And in the female, the list is different, of course. You might have already noticed that there's differences between male and female sexual anatomy, but we'll actually get into those when we look at the female in a different chapter. Let's go on to two and look at this fertilization process. You can see that the male sperm is much smaller than the female egg, and that's because the zygote that results when these two fuse together is really no bigger than the egg, and that's because the sperm doesn't contribute hardly anything except for the DNA. Fertilization always results in that one zygote that results having the DNA from both parents, which is why every individual is different from both parents, at least partially different genetically. Well, different sexual species have different genetic ways of determining what the genetic male is and what the genetic female is. Mammals use what's called the XY system, named after the fact that they have two different kinds of sex chromosomes. Now, any given species has some number of chromosomes, right? And that number, whatever it is, depends on the species. How many chromosomes do humans have? How many different kinds of chromosomes, I should say? 23 different kinds. And by different kinds, I mean each of those chromosomes houses a different number of genes that control different types of things. All right. So of those 23 types of chromosomes, you can categorize them into one or another category. There's two major categories of chromosomes in humans. What are those? Somatic chromosomes? Autosomal chromosomes, right. There are somatic cells and germline cells. But in those cells, there are chromosomes. And so, yes, 22, the first 22, because they're numbered in order of size. Chromosome, human chromosome number 1 through human chromosome number 22, those all belong to chromosomes that are autosomes. They are therefore autosomal chromosomes. But autosome itself means a chromosome about that person's own life. That's what auto means, right? Self. Chromosome number 23 is not an autosome. It is a sex chromosome. Now, sex chromosomes are so called because they determine the sex in one way or another, depending on species. They determine the sex of the individual genetically. But sex chromosomes actually have genes for things that are not related to sex at all. They just happen to be on those, on that chromosome. Anyway, besides that difference, determination of sex versus no determination of sex on the autosomes, there's also the major difference that there are two different versions and sizes of sex chromosomes in humans. All right? There's an X version and there's a Y version, hence the XY system. But X chromosomes are much bigger than Y chromosomes. They're both considered sex chromosomes. They just don't have the same number of genes on them. All right? X is bigger than Y. Well, the XY system is such that having or not having a Y chromosome is what makes the difference between a genetic male and a genetic female. And I say genetic male versus genetic female because that's not the only thing involved in development of one sex or the other. It's just the first step. So a genetic female is a human that has no Y chromosome. A genetic male is one that has a Y chromosome. Now, normal humans have exactly two sex chromosomes and exactly two autosomes of each type as well, right? Because we are diploid organisms, meaning that we get one chromosome of each type, all 23, from one parent, and we get another one of all those 23 from another parent. So we end up with two chromosome number 1, two chromosome number 2, all the way through 23, the two sex chromosomes. But since there are two versions of sex chromosomes, that means any normal individual, genetically speaking, is going to be either have two X's or an X and a Y. And that's because every egg, by virtue of being from a female, has an X in it. Okay? Every egg, every viable egg, has an X chromosome in it. Therefore, every zygote has an X chromosome in it, right? Because a zygote is just a fertilized egg. The variable part depends on the type of sperm that fertilizes the egg. In other words, there are X version sperm, a sperm that's carrying an X chromosome, and there are Y version. All right. Now, the sperm is coming from a male. A male, genetically speaking, is by definition XY. So when it comes time to choosing one of those two gametes, either the X can be chosen or the Y, I mean, choosing one of those chromosomes to make a gamete, either the X chromosome can be chosen or the Y chromosome can be chosen. So males produce two types of sperm, X ones and Y ones. Well, a female is XX, so yes, she randomly chooses one of her chromosomes too, but it ends up being an X in either case. She chooses one X or the other to make her eggs. And therefore, that's why under normal circumstances, the only possibilities for the zygote are XX, a female genetically, or XY. This also means that in the XY system, including humans and other mammals, it's the male parent that makes the determination as to what sex genetically the offspring will be. That's because the female can only give an X to the situation, whereas the male can give either an X or a Y. All right, let's go on to 3 and talk a little bit more about development after fertilization. So fertilization is what's responsible for the genetic sex. But that's just the very first thing that happens. Just because a person is XY genetically does not mean that person is going to develop into having a male body, sexually speaking. A lot of things can go on differently from that genetic determination onward. So that's just part of, the genes are just part of the sex determination. And that's because developmentally, both males and females start out basically the same. And some parts are going to develop while other parts disintegrate in one sex, whereas just the opposite is going to happen in the other sex. But they all start out pretty much neutral. Doesn't matter at all whether they're XX or XY. They all start out the same. And that's what we see at the top. In the early embryo, this is only a little bit over a month into pregnancy, this is what we all look like. We have both male and both pre-male and pre-female parts to us. And in the embryo, notice that there are what are called gonadal ridges, the blue parts that start to develop. The gonadal ridges are going to develop, but they're going to develop either as ovaries or testes, depending on what happens developmentally. Which, of course, depends on the genes involved, but it also depends on other things as well. It depends on hormones operating correctly and correctly having receptors that can recognize those hormones. Now, developmentally speaking, the hormone that determines this is testosterone. And if testosterone is present, and assuming that there are testosterone receptors that are functioning normally in that embryo, then that embryo will go down the path of development that will result in an individual with male characteristics, a male reproductive tract. If there is no testosterone being produced, or very little, or if there aren't receptors that can recognize that testosterone, because hormones don't do anything, remember, unless they bind to a receptor. In the absence of functional testosterone, in other words, then that individual will develop as a female, even if genetically that individual is XY. So it's not that estrogen determines female development and testosterone determines male development, and that's because estrogen is high during this pregnancy time regardless of sex of the embryo. So it wouldn't be useful to have estrogen be the signal that would cause all embryos to develop into females, because the estrogen has to be high because of the pregnancy. All right? Therefore, estrogen is not the signal that matters. It's testosterone. It's either there or it isn't. If it's there, the reproductive tract will develop into a male tract. If not, then it will be female. And we can see what's happening in the two different versions on the bottom. So the gonadal ridges, notice, develop gradually into testes if testosterone is present. And now, if we go back up to the top, notice that the reddish things where the gonadal ridges are forming are called mesonephros, which are kidney-like structures in early development, and they eventually will disintegrate. They don't become the kidneys, but they are kidney-like. And running right alongside that are two important tubes, one of each type for each of the two mesonephros. And those are the mesonephric duct in cyan color, And the paramesonephric duct, which can also be called eponymously the Müllerian duct, as you see in parentheses, that's the one that's violet colored. All right, now we all start out with both of those types, but one is going to be developed and the other one is going to be disintegrated depending on that testosterone signal. If the testosterone is being produced and being received by receptors, then the mesonephric duct is the one that gets chosen for development, and it develops into the ductus deferens of the male. All right? Meanwhile, in that same embryo, which is becoming male, the paramesonephric duct disintegrates. It's not going to be used. And farther down on that left side, that's just by the time you get to birth, it's well developed. But it all starts out by hormonally, via testosterone or absence of testosterone, choosing which two of these ducts gets developed and which one gets disintegrated. If it's the mesonephric duct that gets chosen because of testosterone presence, then you're going to have a male reproductive tract. Just the opposite happens in a female. It's the absence of testosterone that causes the paramesonephric duct to develop in purple or violet, whatever this is. And then the mesonephric duct disintegrates. And so that eventually leads to the female reproductive tract developing. This is all internal genitalia, right? In 4, we can see a similar slide, but here what we're looking at are the external genitalia. And this is still because of the same signaling with respect to hormones. It's just, this is the outwardly visible development that we're seeing here. So we start out with external genitalia that is neutral in a sense. It's neither feminine nor masculine. And it becomes either masculized or feminized depending on absence or presence of testosterone. The coloring here points out homologous structures. Homologous in this sense means that they develop from the same tissue in both males and females, but become different things in the two sexes. All right. So notice that early on we all start out with 3 major parts. The genital tubercle in yellow, the urogenital fold in purple, and the labioscrotal fold in blue. Those haven't been differentiated yet into either male or female parts. In a normally developing male, though, because of the testosterone signal, the genital tubercle becomes the glands of the penis. Glands means the head, which is, in terms of sensitivity, the highest concentration of sensory receptors in the glands of the penis. Whereas the urogenital fold in purple above differentiates into the body of the penis. All right, and the labioscrotal fold in blue develops into not only the scrotum, but the skin covering the penis, including the foreskin, which is also called the prepuce. Now, those 3 beginning points just undergo a different developmental trajectory when the testosterone signal is not there, and that leads to female external genitalia, but they all, these things correspond to each other. Instead of developing into the glands of the penis, the genital tubercle will develop into the glands of the clitoris, which is in a female the place where there's the greatest concentration of sensory receptors for sexual arousal. What in the male became the body of the penis becomes the labia minora. There are 2 sets of labia or lips in the external female genitalia. And then what became the scrotum and covering of the penis in the male become the labia majora. So the larger lips, which is what labia majora means, starts out exactly the same as the scrotum in a male. They correspond to each other. They are homologous, therefore. Okay. Now let's go to 5. And from here on out, I think the rest of it is just males only. We don't really continue to compare males and females. We'll get to females in the other chapter. What we're looking at in 5, though, is what's called the descent of the testes. Actually, I'm going to reverse a little bit of what I just said and say that in both males and females, the gonads, which are the gamete-producing structures, the primary organs, sex organs, testes in male and ovaries in female, start out higher up in the abdominal pelvic cavity. That's where they first develop. And then they both descend, but the ovaries don't descend very far. And they remain in the abdominal pelvic cavity in close relationship with the uterus, as we'll see. In the male, though, the testes, which start out same place, up by the kidneys, descend much farther and actually leave the abdominal pelvic cavity and take up residence, in normal cases at least, in the scrotum. Sometimes things go wrong and the testes do not descend properly. But in most males, they descend properly. And that's occurring during the fetal phase, so before the male is born. We can see this in a 3-month fetus. The testes are still up in the abdominal cavity. What we see, though, is an outpocketing of the peritoneum. The peritoneum is the major serous membrane of the abdominal pelvic cavity. We've talked about that before. Well, we're seeing an outpocketing of the peritoneum down toward the scrotum. When the scrotum first develops, there's nothing in it. It's an empty sac that can receive the stuff that's coming from the abdominal pelvic cavity during the descent of the testes. By the way, there is a fibrous cord connected to the floor of the scrotum on one end and to the testes on the other end. Well, there are two cords, I should say, left and right version. Each one, though, is called a gubernaculum, which is the same root as in gubernatorial, right? Which means having to do with a governor. A governor is someone that guides, supposedly. So the gubernaculum is a cord that guides the descent of the testes so that the testes will end up in the proper place, the left and right sides of the scrotum. We've already seen some descent here because these testes are actually start out farther up, like I said, by the kidneys. All right, and then by 8 months, notice that the outpocketing of the peritoneum has continued to a much greater extent, and it's now starting to pinch off. What we have formed here is what's called the inguinal canal. Inguinal is an adjective that means of the groin. So the inguinal canal, there's an inguinal canal on either side, we're just looking at one side here, is formed during this process of testes descent. At the moment, this bottommost part of what is still officially the peritoneum is called the vaginal process. Now, not vaginal because it has anything to do with vagina. They just are both named it this for the same reason. Vagina means sheath, which means a covering, right? A sheath is a covering for a sword. So the vagina got called that because it's the sheath that accepts the sword, which is the penis. But this vaginal process is called that because it's ensheathing, or at least partially covering, the testis, which is descending. So remember that a serous membrane is a protective membrane that allows for things to move around without damaging nearby things, right? Just like in the pleura and the pericardium, well, also the peritoneum. This is still part of the peritoneum, but it's going to pinch off and become its own little serous membrane in the scrotum. Actually, two of them, one on each side. And that's happened by the time that the baby is about a month old in most cases. You can see that it pinches off totally. So up here is peritoneum, but the part that pocketed out from the peritoneum is now on its own, and it gets renamed once it's on its own, the tunica vaginalis. All right, and by this time, in most cases, the two testes have come totally out of the abdominal pelvic cavity through the inguinal canals and into the two sides of the scrotum. Oh, by the way, I should say that connected to the testis the whole time was the ductus deferens, one for each testis, and also arteries and veins and lymphatic vessels. Those all get dragged along for the ride through the inguinal canal, so that by the time the descent is complete, you have ductus deferens already connected to the testis, but that ductus deferens does not go directly to the penis, which probably a lot of people who've never studied anatomy would guess. As we'll see, sperm that gets produced in the testes, but then has to travel up into the abdominal pelvic cavity and then get secretions added by glands along the way and eventually make it to the penis. It's an indirect route. Okay, now to six. This figure has kind of a special importance for me. This is a self-portrait I made years ago. It was a gift for my grandparents' wedding anniversary. So it's on their mantle. Actually, part of that story is untrue. The main reason for having this slide is to show you what is called the perineum. Perineum is an area on the body that we talk about on the external surface, but its boundaries are defined by bony landmarks, which are deeper. So as you see, it is a quadrangle. There's four corners to it. And the one corner is the pubic symphysis, which is where the two pubes, each a bone, right? Each a part of its own os coxa, where those come together in the front is the pubic symphysis. Remember that? So that's one of the corners. The opposite corner is the coccyx bone, which is the inferiormost of the vertebrae. And then the other two corners are the ischial tuberosities, one on each of the two os coxa. So the ischial tuberosities, remember, if you imagine the os coxa on the full skeleton, the ischial tuberosities are the rounded parts. They're actually what you sit on. It would be that you're sitting on them directly, except that you have muscles and soft tissue padding them. But those are the other two corners. So this overall diamond shape, this quadrangle, is the perineum. Notice that it is broken, though, into two triangles. And so there is the urogenital triangle, so named because it includes structures of both the urinary system and it includes genitals as well, which are part of the reproductive system, and the anal triangle because it includes the anus. So like I said, we usually talk about the perineum as a surface, a visible surface external, but it's defined by bony landmarks. The perineal raphe is just the raphe means seam. And so it looks like a sewn seam right on the midline that extends not only along the scrotum, but in the perineal skin between scrotum and anus. All right, now to seven. Well, in this partial cutaway view, we can see some layering in the external genitalia of the male. In the scrotum, first of all, notice that it is not just a completely open sac. It has a partial boundary between right and left sides called the median septum. What is a septum? Something that separates two sides, right? Or two parts from each other, like the nasal septum separates right and left halves. And it's median septum because it's right on the midline. So this keeps the two testes where they should be, one on the right, one on the left. And it also protects them from, you know, if there's an infection problem on one, it won't spread as easily to the other one, for instance. But it basically is a partial boundary that defines a right and a left half of the scrotum. Now, I talked about tubing being dragged along with the testes during the descent of the testes. And we can see some of the tubing right here. If we dig deep enough, we can see that there is the ductus deferens, one for each testis. That's the brownish one. And then running right alongside it are arteries, veins, and lymphatic vessels. The lymphatic vessels are the yellow ones. But notice that the red ones, which of course are the testicular artery on each side, bringing blood to the arteries, as you'd expect for an artery, is surrounded by a network of veins collectively called the pampiniform plexus. Now, pampiniform simply means shaped like a tendril. But what is a tendril? Well, it's a slender part of a plant. Some plants produce tendrils. They are the things that grow out and try to latch onto something, for instance. So someone named this, for some plant lover who's an anatomist, named it the pampiniform plexus. That's what it means. We'll talk about the importance of that in terms of thermostasis, the maintenance of temperature of the testes, in a minute. Well, maybe not until Wednesday by the looks of this, but that's all part of the ductus deferens plus the pampiniform plexus plus the testicular artery, plus the lymphatic vessels that are running alongside these. All of that make up what is called the spermatic cord. Well, all of that is contained within the spermatic cord, but the spermatic cord, all of those things I just mentioned, are also covered by three layers, which we collectively call the coverings of the spermatic cord. The three layers of the coverings of the spermatic cord are two layers of fascia, internal and external, spermatic fascia. And then in between those two layers of connective tissue fascia, the white layers, is this thin layer of muscle called the cremaster muscle. All right, so the external spermatic fascia, the cremaster muscle, the internal spermatic fascia, all together make up the coverings of the spermatic cord. The spermatic cord itself is the combination of the ductus deferens, the pampiniform plexus, and the testicular artery, and the lymphatic vessels. All right, everyone clear on that? The cremaster gets its name because that means suspender. And the cremaster muscle develops during the descent of the testes. It basically drags muscle from the abdominal pelvic cavity along with it as it grows. And it's called a suspender muscle because to suspend means to hang. Something hangs from a suspender. In this case, what hangs is the testis. And it's a muscle, the cremaster muscle, of course, so it's able to get short on its own. That's what muscles do. They contract. In the case of the cremaster muscle, when it does contract, it will drag the testis closer to the torso. For whatever reason, testes in our species are not in our abdominal pelvic cavity at maturity, which is kind of a puzzle in itself, because these are important organs in terms of perpetuation of the species, right? And they're hung out there for anything to come by and bite off or whatever. You know, it's amazing that they survive as easily as they do. But that's the way we have evolved. Not all mammals are like that. Some mammals keep their testes safe, just like their ovaries, in the abdominal pelvic cavity. But we don't. And now, because of whatever reason has led to that, sperm can't develop well at normal body temperature in the abdominal pelvic cavity. They need to be a little bit cooler than normal body temperature, which is why they hang in the scrotum. All right? But there are three things that actually can adjust that temperature, one of which is the action of the cremaster muscle. In response to too cold a temperature of the testes, the cremaster muscles, or suspenders, will contract and drag those testes closer to the abdominal pelvic cavity, which is going to be warmer than the body. The other two, I guess I'll have to wait until next time to tell you about.